It was only when she let go of Archie that he saw the tight line of her lips. She looked left, right. She was worried, hiding, running, running to Archie. In the pit of his sensitive belly, neurotransmitters registered with a flutter of dread whatever kind of trouble his father was currently getting himself into. Already thinking it might have something to do with Chandler Flowers, his father's best friend back in the day. How Flowers had come into the store today, asking, of all things, "Your dad around?" Luther reported to have been down in West Hollywood someplace, last Archie heard. Not that he ever sought the least news or information of Luther's who, what, where, when, or whyabouts. "Well, it sure has been a long time, Valletta," he said cheerfully, deciding to pretend that he believed she had been driving Luther's car down 61st Street, happened to see him on his front porch, and decided to stop and say hello, as if she could have stared clean through 175 pounds and 30 years to recognize the teenager in whose dreams she briefly but intensely featured. "I do have to rerun him, because I got to, you know, get to the store, but hey, Archie, no, wait, hold up. You have a good day now, all right? No, really, I'm sorry, but you have a positive day." Back when he was a boy, there used to be a gentleman named Joseph Charles. Man would stand out every day at the corner of Oregon and Grove, wearing a pair of dazzling yellow gloves, waving to every car that passed him, extending to his driver, regardless of race, creed, or receptivity, one genuine, heartfelt greeting. Mr. Charles's manner, bold and cheerful, but a touch formal, hinting, though not in any unkind way, at the impersonal. "No intention of greeting you in particular. Simply reminding you that, like all humans, you partook in the noble human capacity for being greeted." It was Mr. Charles's manner that Archie tended to adopt around women when he sensed they might be about to pose him some kind of problem. He gave Valletta's shoulder a fond squeeze, started away. In his heart, he already knew that he was not going to get anywhere, not yet. Like many abandoned sons, he was conscious of owing a mysterious, unrepayable debt toward the man of whom, in truth, he was the eternal creditor. "Archie, it's your dad," she said, tendering that unpayable IOU. "It's Luther." She raised the sunglasses at him and hit him straight on with twin blasts of yellow-brown fire, with the shock of the bitter work of time and corruption. Cakes of mascara cobwebbed her lashes. "Yeah?" Valletta checked out the shadows and rustlings up and down both ends of the street one more time, ran the broom of her paranoia up the quiet little pond of a street built around a pocket playground that some unknown amateur of children had tucked, like an Easter egg, onto an island of grass in the midst of 61st Street. Archie wondered if Valletta might not be high, cashed out on something that was making her go all pensionesque. The last time he found himself unable to prevent hearing news of Luther, it was a tale grand and heartwarming, of cleanness, sobriety, redemption. Luther had drawn a judge down south who remembered Strutter and, never having been the man's son, was willing to take a chance on Luther Stallings, divert him to a drug court. Luther went around after that, supposedly making amends to 17,512 people on two continents. That was at least a year ago, and the amends that Archie consented to allow his father to make to him at the time had consisted, in full, of a sober, clean telephone promise to leave Archie the fuck alone from now until the end of time. "Can we go in?" she wanted to know, sighing, impatient. Maybe, he thought desperately, only needing to pee. "Inside your house?" "Uh-uh," Archie said, not trying to charm or work her anymore. The deep 1978 El Cerrito apartment sulliness starting to seep out of him as he remembered how Luther and Valletta used to leave him there all night by himself. Nothing on the television but Wolfman Jack and some movie where a shark-toothed devil doll was biting Karen Black on the ankles. Only thing he wanted to know now, what kind of bullshit trouble Luther Stallings was trying to get Archie into this go-around, and how much it was going to cost in blood and treasure. Just say what you came to say. No joke, Valletta. I really do have to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you ain't changed, she said, lighting up icy diodes at the heart of those eyes that, in the summer of 1977, had stared not only into Archie's soul, but into the soul of young black America from the covers of Jet and Sepia, and from the feathers, fur, and leather kung fu splendors of her role as Candy Girl Clark in one of the last blaxploitation films of that era, Strutter at Large, in which she co-starred with a lean, wiry, and beautiful Luther Stallings in his most famous part. Still walking around, all pinch-up and pouty-faced, giving everybody a fisheye, most of all your father or his friend. Y'all are still friends, then. We took up with each other again. Third time, you know what they say. Archie had contrived to miss the second near-fatal intersection of Luther and Valletta by cleverly timing his service in the United States Army to coincide with the geopolitical hard-on of Saddam Hussein. He back in town then? She stared him down, challenging him, not wanting to give up anything if he was going to make her stand out on the damn sidewalk to say it. And now you come around here saying Luther sent you, is that right? Come around here hoping to find out what exactly?
Luther don't know nothing about it. Men knew I was here?
She chewed on the earpiece of her sunglasses, seeming to rehearse Luther's anger in her mind.
He knows how you feel. He wants to respect that.
So you don't want money?
Truly, she said, I do. I'll take whatever you can spare me. We need to get far away from here and stay there.
It did not take a lot of effort for Archie to harden his heart against his father. That clay was well fired, long and slow. Anger, resentment, scorn, disgust. Luther's son kept these handy in the pocket of his soul as surely as the copy of Meditations at his hip. So it must testify to something, some abiding foolishness peculiar to the sons of broken fathers, that it took any effort at all. 36 years of this shit, and Archie was still willing to let the man disappoint him.
I'm not going to ask why, Archie said. Because if you don't tell me, then I won't know.
Archie, I can't get into it out here.
I am so fine with that, Valletta.
Your daddy, Luther.
She tried for a couple of seconds, pursing her lips, tapping them pensively with her right fist, to put it into words. Then she gave up.
He been clean and sober 13 months now.
Uh-huh, good for him.
And, like, now he's got some irons in the fire.
I bet he does, Archie said, thinking that was the perfect expression to describe the future as it stood in permanent relation to Luther Stallings.
A big pile of irons glowing red hot, to be snatched from the fire only at the cost of singed flesh.
Investment opportunities, that right?
She fell back once more on her optic beams, but either this time Archie was ready, or the effect had begun to dull. She lowered the sunglasses again.
Let me guess, Archie said, because I am experiencing premonitions.
Chan and Luther unhooked a heavy chain between two pillars, left the tornado tucked into a fold of midnight at the back of a gravel parking lot, crunched up a hillside through fumes of eucalyptus, Chan carrying the shotgun, to a lookout they at one time favored for planning their conquests of the world.
At their spot, Chan turned and swung the gun, let it fly.
It helicoptered out into the night and came whipping down with a clang of pipes somewhere in the woods behind them. Then they sat on their bench, perched side by side on the high shoulder of Oakland, looked out at streets and bridges and highways embroidered, stitched out in lights onto dark panels of water and sky. In the interest of furthering his stone-cold pistolero legend, of which purity was to form a key component, the Undertaker never drank and rarely smoked. Luther passed him a package of cools, and the Undertaker took one and lit it. Luther fished a fifth of Rumpelmans from his jacket pocket.
The Undertaker surrendered the last fragment of his stillborn legend to the possibility of solace offered by the bottle of schnapps.
He grabbed hold of his wrist. Sat there looking at it, Chan said, wiping his lips. Meat and blood, a stump. All calm and collected. Cuff of his jacket shot up to threads, just a rag where his hand used to be. Looking at it.
Popcorn hues, Luther said admiringly.
I need to hide myself, Luther.
Where at? Dread inflated a taut balloon in Luther's ribcage. He could barely muster breath to get out the next syllables. L.A.? For that was the obvious solution. Swing by Luther's mother's house and pick up the canvas suitcase and the three Berkeley Farms crates, packed and ready to go. Hit L.A. by morning. Chan could buy what he needed when they got there. Track down some shipbox safe house where Chan could hold up. Wave goodbye, then. Engage in the theater of turning their separate ways, meeting their respective fates, until the next of his friend's schemes went wrong, the next time Chan found himself confronting the truth that his faith in himself was misplaced, his intelligence fated to go unrewarded because it was no substitute for luck, no proof against the world's massive, even hostile, indifference to the productions of a black man's intellect. Like the party he had joined too late, too young, Chan was a lost claim check, a series of time-lapse photos of a promise as it broke. He was a king of finite space, bound in a nutshell, and Luther was sick of it. He rued all the time he had wasted since the call came from his agent, feeling guilty, feeling sorry for Chan. Or, he said, trying to be helpful, lot of Panthers in Chicago, right? Chan didn't say anything. Morocco, then. Or Spain. Spain, Chan said. Luther could hear the hard little smile creasing his face. Good thinking. Go to Spain. Become a Toronado. Why not? All the revolutionary Negroes be skipping to Morocco, Spain, Paris. You were doing their business. They got to take care of you. Who? The party. Luther, if I had the kind of clout get myself that far away from him, I wouldn't have needed to impress anybody in the first place with the fool thing I just tried to do. Somewhere right around here, Luther remembered, if you went farther up the path behind the picnic tables, you would stumble across a pyramid of built-up stones left behind by some crazy old beard-faced poet back when Oakland was nothing but a slough and a stables and a cowboy hotel. In school, they came up here on field trips, checking out the poet's little white farmhouse, a big lumpy statue of him riding on a mongoloid-looking horse. A pyramid of stone and farther back a stone platform the man had built, intending it to be used for his funeral pyre. Out here in the hot sun, day after day, the man piling up rocks like lines in one of his boring poems, dreaming the whole time he was stacking those rocks about how all those olden-time gangsters of Oakland, those whoring, robbing, land-grabbing Indian killers, opium addicts, and loot-seekers down there in the flatlands, how some fine night they were going to look up here at this green slope and marvel at the spectacle of a burning poet. Nothing ever came of that plan, far as Luther could recall. But then, that was the general tendency of plans.
If you're a fool, Luther said, what's that make me?
This was a question that could never be answered, and Luther carried swiftly on to the next.
Why'd I want to go and mess up my good thing, driving your murder taxi around West Oakland, he said. Tell me that. So the Marxist gangsters can roll over the running dog capitalist gangsters? Take over their drugs and cash flow?
Leave then, Chan said. You're not in this. You go on, get. Before Luther could begin to feign that he was not entertaining this generous suggestion, there was a flicker of moonlight, like the bright quick of a fingernail at the corner of his eye. Chan was pondering a handgun, taken like the shotgun, no doubt, from the party arsenal that it was Chan's official duty to keep inventoried, secret, and in fighting shape. A 45, a handsome piece, probably brand new. Luther's heart misgave at the way Chan was balancing it on both palms, weighing it like a heavy book that held a heavy answer.
What you going to do with that? Luther said.
Try again, Chan said at last. Find out what hospital they took popcorn to. He found a solid grip on the pistol.
Get it right the second time.
Maybe you ought to talk to somebody first. Maybe Huey'd be satisfied with what you already did to fuck popcorn up for him.
A fog began to blur the prospect of Oakland spread beneath them. Silence gathered around the friends until it felt like something profound. The coals of their cigarettes flared and crackled. The fog hissed like carbonation in a drink.
You remember what your Uncle Oogie used to do on your birthday? At Christmas? Chan said finally.
Listen, I was gonna get you an air rifle.
His imitation of Oogie's mumbly drawl was flawless, expecting you to be as grateful as if he did give it to you.
Now I'm supposed to say, Huey, I was gonna kill Popcorn Hughes for you, but,
Why not?
Why not? Chan said, making it come out high and childish.
Easy for you to say. Tell me this. You get down there on that movie set, are you going to forget your lines? Tell the director.
I meant to memorize that shit, but, no.
Are you?
No.
Then why do you want me to do it?
Come on, then, Luther said. Let's go.
Go where?
Let's get out of here. You come with me down to L.A. Hide out down there, San Pedro, Long Beach. Trying to summon or feign enthusiasm for his proposal.
Yeah, Ensenada.
It was too dark for Chan to see what was not in Luther's eyes, and too dark for Luther to see him missing it. Chan stood up and dropped the 45 into his hip pocket. It rattled against the extra shotgun rounds.
I woke up this morning, he said, had all kinds of beautiful intentions, proved myself to the supreme servant of the people. Take a major annoyance off his hands. Move in, move up, maybe in a year I'm running the Oakland chapter. Then I get my eye on the account books, see what kind of holes might be in them, waste and whatnot. Bring a little more structure, a little more discipline. Now, no, uh-uh. Now I just have to make it right.
You go on, though. Go on, Luther, and get your good thing.
His voice broke, and from the crack in it, emerged the voice of the boy he recently was, fiercely shy and bookish, absorbing without saturation on behalf of his sisters and his baby brother, the endless seep of the elder Flowers' venom. At the memory of that vanished boy, Luther regretted, without entirely renouncing his earlier disloyal thoughts. He put his arm around the professorial shoulders of his friend. "It's already too wrong, Chan," he said.
No way you can make it right.
That is probably true.
You got to leave. Come on, come to L.A. Hole up, ride it out.
I appreciate the gesture, Luther, Chan said.
I already troubled you sufficiently.
Then go somewhere else.
Where?
Anywheres that a bus could take you.
Maybe I will, Chan said, to end the conversation.
When the peppermint brandy was drunk, they got up and left behind them the spot where a forgotten dreamer of the California dream had planned to have his glory notarized by fire. Turned and hiked, sliding back down to the car. After a silent drive to the bottom of the city, the blue dome of the Greyhound station loomed before them like a promise of adventure. There was an OPD cruiser parked at the curb when they pulled up, but before they could consider bailing on the bus station plan, a cop came strolling out of the station, got back into the car, and drove away. Luther had $300 in his wallet, all that was left of his upfront money. He handed it over to Chan.
"Okay, then," he said.
They stood facing each other at the back of the Toronado. Its taillights were slits as narrow as the eyes in the Batman mask, a skeptical squint regarding them. The friends exchanged a couple of palm slaps.
Each clasped the other briefly to his chest. Chan offered up some parting bullshit about catching a northbound up to Alaska. Or maybe head south, work those shrimp boats down in the Gulf of Mexico. It was all smoke. Chan had never been a boy to leave food on a plate. A math problem without a solution. An open pussy unfucked. He wasn't going to go into the bus station, get on a bus for North Nowhere. Soon as Luther left, he would get busy finishing for the sake of finishing the trouble he had started. Seriously, Luther said, what you gonna do?
You don't need to know, Luther. Tell you this, though, whatever it is, when I'm done, I'm gonna be able to hold my head up high.
I know that's true. See, you do the same down there. Comport your ass with dignity. Do what you have to do. Yeah. Promise? Yeah. Luther tried not to show his impatience, his eagerness to get quit of Chandler Bankwell Flowers III and his cup of clabbered ambition. To get quit of Oakland and Berkeley and all the local fools, the broken promises, the pyres that never got lit.
You are having good luck right now, Chan said. Good luck is good. But that's all it is, you dig? Not any kind of substitute for doing what you have to do.
Luther nodded, said, no doubt, no doubt. Thinking about the ads you used to see in the pages of Ebony, an Esquire, selling the long, low, smiling crocodile of 1970, the slogan across the top of the page, wouldn't it be nice to have an escape machine? I know what it means, Luther said.
Huh? Chan said. What?
I can define Toronado. Chan frowned. Remembered, frowned more deeply.
Do it then, he said.
Luther shook his head. You don't need to know, he said. Then he strapped himself into his escape machine and headed for the Nimitz Freeway, San Jose, Los Angeles, the world and the fortune that awaited him. Popcorn Hughes, Luther heard afterward, was shot to death early that morning in his bed at Summit Hospital. The only suspect was the unknown, unidentified black male who had been described by witnesses to the first attack at the Bitter Honey Lounge as wearing a mask that was meant, it was generally agreed, to resemble the one worn in Marvel Comics by the Black Panther, the first black superhero. The killer was never apprehended. The Toronado overheated in the grapevine just north of Lubbock and had to be towed across the L.A. County line. He's looking for investors, Archie guessed. Valletta affected to study some scene or detail in the distance, beyond the playground, beyond Berkeley, beyond Mount Lassen, saying nothing, infinitesimally shaking her head, mouth down twisted in a way that might have been disapproving of Archie, Luther, herself, or some combination thereof, arms crossed furiously under her breasts. Unable to believe, finally, that she was party to this latest bullshit scheme of Luther's, or that Archie declined to be party to it, or perhaps that the world did not, never would, appreciate the genius of Luther Stallings.
He's still talking about that damn movie? What'd you think?
She rummaged around in her bag and took out what appeared to be a box set of three DVDs entitled The Strutter Trilogy. Its cover featured a handsome close-up shot of the long-jawed, Roman-nosed, Afro-haloed 1973 vintage Luther Stallings as master thief Willie Strutter, and it promised restored or digital versions of three films, Strutter, Strutter at Large, and Strutter Kicks It Old School. But it was an empty hunk of packaging with no discs inside. Then on closer inspection, it proved to have been painstakingly crafted from the cardboard case to a complete Back to the Future box set, over whose panels had been pasted vivid but crudely executed cut-and-paste computer artwork. A minor but necessary bit of imposture, since as far as Archie knew, and he knew far, too far, there was no such movie as Strutter Kicks It Old School. Strutter 3, is that right? Going to write and direct and star? Triple threat? Gonna make it fast, cheap, and badass like they used to do back in the day. Old school. And you're gonna be his leading lady. That the story he sent you here to tell me, Valletta? Out of gentlemanly impulses and, worse, feeling sorry for this woman, one of a string he had auditioned during his childhood for the role of Archie's new mother, Archie struggled to keep a tone of derision from creeping into his voice as he offered this bit of informed speculation as to Luther's line, phrases such as triple threat, and fast, cheap, and badass, having formed part of his father's formulary of bullshit over the years. He did not entirely succeed. The only thing lamer than the piece-of-shit plan Luther had come up with for peeling money loose from Archie for a film that he had not the least intention of making was the idea that Luther thought his son would give him anything ever again. He's gonna put in a nice big part for you. That right, Valletta? Maybe somehow it turns out Candy Girl wasn't dead all along. He detected a ripple along the muscles of her cheek. She held on to her silence, watching as Tibetan flags strung from the front porch of the Sandersons' house across the park bade their random prayers farewell. "We're in pre-production," she said at last, defiant, lying the lie. "So you what? You have a script?" "Nah, but your dad, he has the story all figured out. Told me the whole thing, every character, every shot, every minute of screen time. Told it 10 different ways, 500 times. Archie, it's gonna be good." "Kind of a what? Strutter comes out of retirement, one last job, gets his revenge type of thing? You want to hear how it goes?" Archie closed his eyes, anticipating the tedious madness of the scenario that he was about to be pitched. Some kind of incoherent mashup of Ocean's 11, The Matrix, and Death Wish, his father's favorite movie, interlarded with a thick ribbon drawn from the saga of whatever kind of bullshit landlord trouble or IRS trouble or dental trouble his father and the lady had gotten themselves into. But Valletta fell silent again, and he opened his eyes to find a lone tear lingering on her cheek, a tiny, solitary pool of outrage or shame. He felt his heart sink and drew another draft on his endless reserve of misplaced guilt. He took out his billfold and conducted a sorry inventory therein. "Nah," she said, pushing away from her the bills that emerged, 4 crisp 20s, a faded 5, and 2 soft, crumpled 1s. "Nah, never mind. Keep your money. I didn't come here to bother you for money. I know you don't believe that." "Sure I, and I did not come here to bother you with that motherfucking movie you and I both know ain't ever going to get made." "Okay. I know if I told you your dad was in trouble because of the drugs, you wouldn't feel inclined to help him in any way, shape, or form. And since I got with the program 14 months and 9 days clean and sober, I respect that position, and so does he. What I want to ask you is, what if we was in some other kind of trouble? Didn't have nothing to do with using. Would you possibly be willing to help him out then?" "What did he do?" Again, the careful study of the street, the neighboring trees and houses. "I don't really know," she said, "but hypothetical."
"Hypothetical?
Hypothetical. If that man's hair was on fire, I would not piss on his head to put it out."
She put her sunglasses back on.
"That's just a theory, though," Archie said. "We don't need to test it."
She nodded, chewing her lip, and he saw that under the lipstick, it was already ragged with chewing. "Go on, Valletta," he said, pressing the money on her. "If you promise not to tell me where he's living at, or what he's doing, or how bad he looks, or give me any information at all, that's worth 87 to me right there." She considered it. Her tongue emerged from her lips and ran around her mouth once hungrily. Then she knitted up the money in her long fingers and made it vanish so quickly and completely that she might have been alluding to the length of time it was likely to spend in her pocket. She would not take the empty DVD box.
"Nah, y'all keep that anyway. He got 5 more just like it."
"All right." He took the box, Jack, with a handful of beans already awash in $87 worth of regret over his own stupidity.
Maybe I should come back next week, Valletta said, and a smile, lacking one lower bicuspid, made a brave appearance along the lowermost regions of her face.
Come up with a few more things about him you don't want to hear. See what that gets me.
Funny, Archie said.
Don't worry, you won't see me again.
Valletta?
She started for the Toronado, but he called her back.
Come on, he told her.
You gotta say it. During the summer of 1978, Valletta's summer, the t-shirt shops of urban America had offered for sale an iron-on transfer that depicted Valletta Moore in a bell-bottom zebra print pantsuit, surrounded by the glitter balloon letters of the catchphrase with which she would forever be associated, first spoken in Strutter at Large. The iron-ons were produced by Roach, Kings of the Rubber Transfer, who had divided all the profits, presumably considerable, with retailers and the movie's distributors.
You want me to say it, she said, doubtful, pleased.
I think $87 buys me that, Archie said.
She sighed, pumped her fist once, like it was the head of a very heavy hammer, and said, do what you got to do.
The fist burst apart in slow motion, fingers blooming, and stay fly. She wrestled with the steel of the car door, resuscitated the engine by patience and finesse, and rolled, shocks creaking, away.
Stay fly, Valletta, Archie said.
Julius Jaffe was rereading his memoir in progress, working titled Confessions of a Secret Master of the Multiverse. He had begun to write it 2 months earlier in a 6-inch moleskin, in a fever of boredom, drug sick on H.P. Lovecraft, intending to produce an epic monument to his loneliness and to the appalling tedium he induced in himself. That first night he had cranked out 32 unruled pages. Page one started thus.
This record of sorrow is being penned in human blood on parchment made from the hides of drowned sailors. Its unhappy author, oh, pity me, friend, wherever you lie at your ease, perches by the high window of a lightning-blasted tower, on a beetling skull rock beside the roaring madness of a polar sea, chained at the ankle to an iron bedstead, gnawing on the drumstick of a roasted rat, scribbling with tattered quill on an overturned tub, his sole illumination a greasy flame guttering in a blubber lamp, a prisoner of ill fortune, a toy of destiny, a wretched cat's paw for gods of malice, who find sport in plucking the wings from the golden butterfly of human happiness. Thus shorn of liberty and burdened with the doubtful gift of time, do I propose to ease the leaden hours in setting down this faithful record, the memoir of a king in ruins. The night after he penned these words, Titus Joyner had appeared on the scarp of Julie's solitude, swinging his grappling hook. Since then, Julie had not added a word to his chronicle of boredom. He closed the moleskin, fitted his memoirs with a little elastic strap, his own heart cinched with a tender compassion for their boy author in that distant age. The front door slammed, and the secret master of the multiverse said,
shit!
Titus, Julie said, it's my dad! Get up!
Titus Joyner lay on his back with the pillow mashed down over his face, held in place by the hook of an arm. That was how he slept, shielded. Titus from Tyler, in Julie's imagination, a sun-blasted and horizonless patch of infinite Texas, a necromantic Dia de los Muertos city of prisoners and roses, where Titus had been raised by a forbidding grandmother known as Shy. In Julie's imagination, Shy was all in black, lit by lightning. Dead now, and Titus cast to his fate, claimed like a lost hat by an auntie from Oakland, a stranger from a house of strangers.
Dude,
Julie said in a whisper,
T.
Julie reached for the portable 8-track cassette player Archie had picked up for him at the Alameda swap meet. It was tank core green, styled like a field radio, and it had a webbed strap so that a soldier of funk, Julie supposed, could march his groove around. He popped out Inner Visions, Motown 1973, one of the few among the small stock of 8-track cassettes he had managed to scrounge that Titus would consent to listen to, and shoved in with a meaty thunk, Point of No Return, Kirshner, 1977, aware of how it would irritate his father.
Julie, you up there?
Enigmatic white Midwesterners of the 1970s aired curious ideas about the role of the violin and the organ in a rock and roll context. Titus dragged the pillow from his head and sat up, awake, looking right at Julie. Then, before Julie was quite aware of it, scrambling up out of the bed, buck naked, as Titus called it. Titus crumbled up his clothes into an armload, went to the window, spun around, and confronted an Art Deco chiffarobe that belonged to Julie's great-grandmother. It opened with a great-grandmotherly creak, and Titus climbed inside. Julie accepted this move without considering whether it was necessary or desirable. He knew. He knew more than me or you. You can tell by the pictures he drew.
"Hide the hookah," his father said. "I'm coming up."
With a solemn intake of breath, Julie activated his secret master training. He would use his field of silence, he thought, in combination with his scowl of resounding finality. The door swung open and his father looked in, eyes bright and sunken, cheek nicked by the razor in one of his old-time hip-cat suits. He had that shifty-eyed look he got whenever he had just done something he probably ought not to have done. This might not be a bad time, Julie saw, to confess or at least allude to his own most recent instance of bad behavior. Yet there was something he loved about the way Titus had entered into conspiracy with the chiffarobe. His father covered the fact that he was sniffing the air of the room for the molecular residue of burnt cannabis by making a show of sniffing the air of the room.
"You just sitting around?" he said.
Julius Lovecraft Jaffe. Though on his passport the middle name, by one of those metaphysical clerical errors, forever being committed by reality on the true nature of his being, read Lawrence, gazed calmly back at his father. He sat on his bed cross-legged, in his tie-dyed long johns. Not the tie-dyed long johns with the infinite Escher stairway silk-screened across the chest, but the ones with the space galleon setting sail for Tau Ceti across a sea of stars, which he had purchased last spring in the women's section at Sharks, where they had been labeled with a handwritten tag on which was printed in an architect hand and in terms guaranteed to finger the deepest chords of his soul, cool 70s space kitsch. The field of silence pulsed steady and thick as a stream of annihilating syrup. The scowl burned shimmering hot pathways in the air between Julie and his father.
"What is that?"
His father's face seized up around the eyes, and his cheeks went hollow. He looked like a man with inner ear problems, halfway between disoriented and about to vomit.
"My God," he said. "Please, tell me you aren't listening to Kansas."
There was a small progbin at Brooklyn, but it spurned the pinnacles and palisades in favor of the dense British thickets, swarms of German umlauts. Wandering to Brooklyn hoping to sell a copy of Point of No Return, or say, Brain Salad Surgery, Manticore, 1973, they would need a shop vac to hose up your ashes. Julie took his wallet from the back pocket of his cut-off denim shorts. It was a yellow plastic wallet, printed with a scratched image of Johnny Depp sporting hair of the 80s, and the words 21 Jump Street in fake Wild-style lettering. He unsnapped the wallet's coin purse, in which he rotated a selection from the variety of business cards he had printed up for himself at Kinko's at the beginning of the summer, just before he met Titus. A well-chosen card had served him well a number of times since then as a substitute for conversation, particularly with his parents. This time he chose one that read, Julius L. Jaffe, Curator.
"I have to admit," his father said, sounding like the admission was not a costly one, "I'm getting pretty fucking sick of these fucking cards."
He passed it back to Julie, who returned it to his wallet and put Johnny Depp back in the pocket of his shorts.
"What's with the enormous shoes?"
They were size 15 Air Jordans, white on white on white. They looked like a couple of scale model Imperial destroyers docked neatly on a deck of the Death Star. Julie considered making this claim. He saw that he would have to collapse the field of silence, at least temporarily, and throw up a snare of deceit,
It's that art project, he said. The one I told you about.
This strategy, Julie's mother called it gaslighting, could be surprisingly effective on his father, who spent so much time lost in his own humming that he sometimes missed out on real-world events.
Huh? His father said.
There was no good reason to lie. On some level, Julie knew that. His parents had to figure slash understand that Julie was semi-bi curious, or maybe even gay, or what have you. 25 minutes to gay o'clock. But the confession felt like too much work. Titus was too hard to explain. He was, for example, straight up noon straight, both hands on the 12, though that had not prevented him from accepting every last note and coin of Julie's virginity over the past 2 weeks. There was so much more to it than sex, gender, race, and all that piddly shit. Julie felt that his life had suddenly, like amino acids in the primordial soup, begun to knot and pattern and complicate itself. How to confess that he had sneaked out with his skateboard every night to hook up with Titus, in slang but also quite literally joining himself by the hand to Titus's shoulder as they rolled through the nighttime summer streets of South Berkeley and West Oakland, through the wildly ramifying multiverse of their mutual imagination. Titus preferred the street to the roof and walls within which a hard fate and a 90-year-old batshit auntie had obliged him to shelter, and Julie preferred nothing to the feeling of Titus's shoulder bone and muscle against his hand, preferred nothing to the grind of his wheels, each tree, parked car, and lamppost a whisper as they passed.
It's that thing at Habitat, Julie added for verisimilitude. I have to decorate them.
His father nodded knowledgeably. There was no other way that he knew how to nod.
So what are you doing?
He said.
Playing MTO?
As a matter of fact, before Titus nodded off, they had been taking turns at Julie's laptop, logged on to Marvel Team-Up Online, leveling up their latest characters, Desire and the Black Answer, running them in their capes and energy auroras through the teeming streets of Hammer Bay on the island of Genosha. Julie said,
filing my teeth.
Uh-huh. Not smoking dope.
Just crack. And a little opium. Just, like, this much.
He pinched an imaginary pellet between his fingertips.
Fuck, Dad.
Because, you know, it would be all right if you did.
Yes, Dad.
Not all right. But, I mean, if you were getting high, I would want you to tell me about it, right?
Right.
Not feel like you have to hide it or anything.
I get it.
Because that's when you start to drift into stupid. Julie said that he planned to continue his lifelong policy of avoiding stupid at every opportunity.
So, his father said, just sitting here? What, feeling sorry for yourself?
I don't need anybody's pity, Julie replied, seeing the words scrawl themselves across the page of his imagination in the florid hand he had affected when writing in his moleskin with his fountain pen.
Least of all, my own.
That raised a smile on his father's face.
Why are you even here in the middle of the day? Julie said.
I came home, his father said.
I guess I should probably go back.
The shorter his father's stories got, the more unwise or embarrassing his behavior turned out to have been. His father's eyes wandered, unseeing, for the 1,007th time across the artwork that Julie had drawn and pinned to the lath ceiling. The portraits of cybernetic pimp assassins and blind albino half-Juton swordsmen, and one cherished sketch of Doctor Strange produced with Crayolas and a flare pen when Julie was 5 or 6. A Nausicaa poster, the Israeli one-sheet for Pulp Fiction. The gatefold inner sleeve of a record called Close to the Edge, Atlantic, 1972. With this world of cool, enigmatic waterfalls that endlessly pour their green blueness into infinity. His father, seeing nothing, understanding nothing, searching for the line, the signal, the telling bit of repartee. Recently and unexpectedly, the fiber optic cable between the continents of father and son had been severed by the barb of some mysterious dragging anchor. His father stood there in the attic doorway, with his hands in the jump-jive pockets of his suit jacket, loving Julie with a glancing, half-sly caution that the boy could feel and yet be certain of the uselessness thereof, that love occupying, as it did, only one small unproductive zone of the greater uselessness that seemed to pervade his father's life from pole to pole. Did something happen with Archie? Julie said. With Archie? Something at the store.
At the store?
Question with a question?
Sorry.
What did you do?
Nothing, I didn't. I just kind of blew my stack.
Oh, Dad.
At Chan Flowers, Councilman Flowers.
Whoa!
Yep. Is that guy kind of, like, scary? I've always thought so, yes.
Kind of a creeper?
At times he gives off that vibe.
But he buys a lot of records.
An all-too-common conjunction of behaviors.
And you yelled at him?
Threw him out, actually, Nat said. Then I threw out every other schmageggy in the joint.
Oh, fuck, Dad.
Then I closed the store for good. How do you like that?
You what? For good?
As in out of business.
You closed the store? I really felt I had no choice. For good?
Question with a question, his father said.
Look, I'm fine. I got over myself. Now I'm going to go back, say I'm sorry to Arch. I'll apologize to Flowers, Moby, everybody else who needs it. Apologies are cheap, Julie, and effective, all out of proportion to their cost. My father used to say, carry 'em like a roll of bills in your hip pocket. Pass 'em out freely. Remember that.
Cool. Okay.
Used to say, they're good for business, and they make the world a better place. Clearly, his dad was cycling high today, getting that Groucho Marx quality to his delivery. For years, he had been on and off various medications, whose names sounded like the code names of sorceresses or ninja assassins, disastrous from the first dose or disappointing in the long run. Each wore out its welcome in his father's bloodstream without ever managing to lay an insulating glove on the glowing wire inside him. His moods had little in the way of pattern or regular rotation apart from the possible intensification in Septembers and Februarys. But if Julie had, over time, learned to live unshaken by his father's unpredictable temblors of mania, he had grown inured as well to their completely predictable aftermaths, however heartfelt, of apology and remorse.
Say sorry, Nat said. Then open the store back up like I was, you know, on a little mental lunch break.
False alarm. Everybody go about your business.
Except Gibson Good, right?
Whatever, his father said. Man has the right to sell what he wants, where he wants. Bring him on. Meanwhile, you, cheer up. You got 2 more weeks of summer to get through.
With a wan crackle, the field of silence fluttered back to life between them. And he tried, but before he could tell us, he died. His father closed the door. Julie listened for the creak of his passage down the twisting stair. The narrow, mirrored door of the old Art Deco chiffon robe swung open, betraying the folded, articulate span, half-dressed in pressed blue jeans of Titus Joyner.
Yo, yo, yo,
Titus said. Bit by careful bit, he took himself out of the chiffon robe and reassembled himself on the floor of Julie's bedroom, a hitman snapping together the pieces of his rifle. He looked tired. He smelled like the locker room at the Y.
5 more minutes, he said.
He enrolled himself along the floor of Julie's room, on the coiled braids of a rag rug, and stretched out. He closed his eyes. His breathing turned solemn and slowed the rise and fall of his chest. He was a prodigy of furtive and impromptu sleep. The nightly bed that fate furnished him was a zone of danger and dark insomnia. If you close your eyes in that unsafe house, they would rifle your nightmares and violate your dreams.
Titus, Julie said. Yo, T.
Nothing. Gone. Julie pulled the quilt from his bed and laid it over Titus. It was an antique of the '80s, Michael Jackson in a tacky spacesuit with a motley crew of robots and aliens. Julie stared at the boy on his floor, a mystery boy fallen from the sky like the Wald Newton meteorite.
apparently inert and yet invisibly seething with the mutagenic information of distant galaxies and exploding stars. Julie was in love.